Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Simon Sinek. Simon is a leadership expert, a best-selling author of multiple books, including Leaders Eat Last, Start With Why, and most recently, The Infinite Game. He's also famous for his 2009 TED Talk on the concept of why, which remains the third most watched TED Talk of all time, with over 50 million views. Simon's innovative writing focuses on the concept of how leaders can inspire cooperation, trust, and change. Being trained in ethnography, Simon has been fascinated with how leaders and organizations can change the world and continues to write on patterns of thinking, acting, and communicating in the most successful ways. In this interview, Simon talks at length about his book, The Infinite Game, explaining what the difference is between finite and infinite games, and what factors are most important in the latter. Simon warns that the dangers of playing infinite games with a finite mindset hurts trust, cooperation, and innovation. He also shares that there's no such thing as a natural-born leader, as well as the importance of having empathy in leadership. He also explains how he became obsessed with the idea of why, the topic of his most famous TED Talk, and a variety of other topics. Simon Sinek, welcome to the podcast. Great to speak with you today.
Thanks for having me.
Simon, you're the author of several best-selling books, most recently The Infinite Game, which is a terrific read. Congratulations on it. You draw the distinction of finite versus infinite games, and you note in the book that there's a lot of confusion of people playing infinite games, but believing they're in finite games. Could you take a moment to elaborate on the contrast between the two and some of the learnings that you've had in your investigation of them?
Yeah, my view of how the world works, especially how the business world works, really shifted when I discovered James Carse's work. James Carse is a philosopher. In 1986, he wrote a little book called Finite and Infinite Games, where he defines these two kinds of games. As you articulated, the finite game is known players, fixed rules, and an agreed upon objective. There's always a beginning, a middle, and an end. An infinite game is known and unknown players. The rules are changeable, which means you can play however you want. And the objective is to perpetuate the game, to stay in the game as long as possible. And we are players in infinite games every day of our lives, games that have no finish line. For example, there's no such thing as being number one in friendship or being number one in your marriage. There's no such thing as winning global politics. There's no such thing as winning career. There's no such thing as winning learning. And there's definitely no such thing as winning business. No one has ever declared the winner of business. And yet I find it so interesting. If we listen to the language of so many leaders, especially business leaders, they talk about being number one, being the best, or beating their competition. Based on what? Based on what agreed upon objectives, based on what agreed upon timeframes, based upon what agreed upon metrics, and based, in other words, there is no finish line. And so what I've learned is that when we play in an infinite game, like business, with a finite mindset, playing to win or thinking we can be number one, what ends up happening is we actually hurt trust, hurt cooperation, and hurt innovation, all of which weaken the organization and eventually contribute to its eventual demise.
Simon, you highlight a few different factors that are key in an infinite game. You talk about just cause, courageous leadership, trusting teams, a worthy rival, and existential flexibility. Could you take a moment and describe each of these with an example for each?
Yeah, I can run through those. So a just cause is a cause so just that we would be willing to sacrifice our interests in order to advance that. So one of my favorite examples is the Declaration of Independence. The founding fathers of the United States wrote down an idealized vision of the future. A future state that did not exist and still does not exist, in which all people are created equal, all men are created equal, endowed with unalienable rights, amongst which include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, that's what vision is. It's an idealized statement of the future that we commit our efforts and our products and our company to advance towards that idealized state. the winning of the Revolutionary War was just the first step on this long, long journey. And we've seen milestones along the way, the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, civil rights, gay rights, all of which are milestones, all of which are incomplete in them to themselves, but marching us towards this idealized vision, this just cause that America is trying to advance. We'll never actually get there, but we'll die trying. And that's the point. And organizations, including businesses, can have a just cause, a statement of the future, so just that their people would be willing to sacrifice in order to advance it. So, for example, turning down a better paying job offer, the willingness to go on frequent business trips or work late, even though we may not like these things, they feel worth it because we feel like our work has meaning, like we're contributing to something beyond the products we sell or the money we make. And if we don't give our people a sense of just cause, something to advance that's bigger than the company, bigger than the products we make and sell, then the relationships become much more transactional and the organization starts operating in a much more finite way, really just interested in short-term gain. So, you know, it really have to have a just cause in this infinite game. The second thing is building trusting teams. We all know what it's like to work on a trusting team. It means we can come to work and feel secure to say, I made a mistake, or I'm having stress at home, it's affecting my work, or I've been promoted to a position where I don't fully understand the job, I need some more training, or I'm scared, or I need help, without any fear of humiliation or retribution. In fact, what ends up happening is we do these things and say these things with total confidence that our bosses or our peers will rush in to support us. If we don't have trusting teams, what we have is a group of people who show up to work every day lying, hiding, and faking. They're hiding mistakes. They're not admitting that they don't know what they're doing. And they're never going to ask for help for fear that it puts them on some short list at the next round of layoffs, or that it'll prevent them from getting promoted or something like that. But the problem with that is if we're hiding mistakes and people are pretending that they know everything that they have to do or can do, eventually these things compound and it weakens the organization. So to truly last in the infinite game of business, we have to commit to building trusting teams. And what's required to do that is good old-fashioned leadership. Good leadership is what produces trusting teams. And they're absolutely essential. The next one is worthy rivalry, where in finite games, we have competitors, and competitors are there to be beaten. There's a winner and there's a loser in a finite game. In the infinite game, there's no such thing as winning or losing. There's only ahead and behind. You can be number one in whatever metric you choose or time frame you want, but you know, for now, you're number one for now. And so instead of viewing the other players in the game as competitors, it's much healthier in the infinite game to view them as worthy rivals. A worthy rival is another player whose strength reveals to you your weaknesses. There are other companies out there who they're better marketers. Their products are better. Their leadership is better. Their culture is stronger. Their vision is clearer. And instead of being uncomfortable when their name comes up or trying very hard to undermine and simply be ahead in the metrics, it's better to take all that energy that competitive energy and take a hard look at yourself and see where you have room to improve. And ultimately, that's the value of worthy rivals. They point out our weaknesses so that we may become stronger, better players in the game. Again, remember, the game is not to beat the competition. The goal is to outlast them. The existential flexibility is the willingness to make a profound strategic shift in order to better advance your just cause. This is not the daily flexibility required in business. This is the willingness to walk away from money spent or invested or even time spent because you find a better way to advance the cause. I think the best example of this is when Steve Jobs and some of his senior executives visited Xerox in 1979. Apple was already a big company. It already had success from the Apple I and the Apple II. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak had a just cause, which was to empower the individual to stand up to Big Brother, which is why they were so enamored by the personal computer, because it gave individuals power to compete against corporations even. And when Steve Jobs and his executives went to visit Xerox PUC, Xerox showed them a new invention that they'd come up with called the graphic user interface, which allowed people to use computers not by having to learn a computer language, but by clicking on a mouse and moving a cursor on a screen to move around icons and folders on a desktop. And Jobs saw this technology as a leapfrog to help him advance towards his cause of empowering individuals, even more individuals, to be able to stand up to Big Brother and take advantage of this personal computer technology. And so when they left Xerox, he said to his executives, we have to invest in this graphic user interface thing. And one of the executives said, Steve, we can't. We've already invested millions of dollars and countless man hours in something else. If we invest in this, we'll blow up our own company. To which Jobs actually said, better we should blow it up than someone else. That decision led to the Macintosh, a computer platform so profound that it literally changed the way we use computers today. The entire software of Windows is designed to act like a Macintosh. That's existential flexibility. And then the courage to lead is the final one, because all of the things I've just run through are actually really difficult. Being short-term focused is easier. Trying to exert control over numbers is easier. Hiring and firing people at willy-nilly is easier than the hard work of good leadership. And ultimately, so many of the pressures upon us are forcing us to play the finite game. Incentive structures force us to focus down. If you work for a public company, the pressures from Wall Street and the public markets are all forcing us to think shorter and shorter term. So it takes tremendous courage to stand up and take an entirely different point of view in how we're building our businesses.
You also highlighted that you need to think of yourself as the competitor. And this includes having the courage to cannibalize your own offering, to rethink elements, cancel projects, and develop a new product that competes with your own. Take a moment to elaborate on this a bit.
In the infinite game, the only true competitor is yourself, where the goal is to make our products better this year than they were last year, to make our culture stronger this year than it was last year, to make our products, our leaders, better leaders this year than they were last year. That's the only, you know, if we're trying to outdo anyone, it should be to try and outdo ourselves. Yes, that's true. And we still pay attention to the other players in the market because we have to know what they're doing, as I said before, because things they're doing may challenge us. Remember when Microsoft had this finite view of the world back in the day, and Apple had this infinite view. Apple was trying to advance a cause, and Microsoft was trying to beat Apple. And so in the days of the iPod, Microsoft kept coming out with new and more improved Zunes, which was their MP3 player, and their express purpose was they were trying to beat Apple. Steve Ballmer was very open about it, how he was trying to beat Apple. And the funny thing is Apple was completely playing a different game. While Microsoft was trying to make a better MP3 player, Apple had already moved on and was developing the iPhone, which rendered both the iPod and the Zune completely obsolete. They were playing an entirely different game.
Across your books, a common theme is leadership. You're a big believer that leaders aren't just born, as some of us have been led to believe, but that leadership can be learned. Take a moment to elaborate on that perspective, if you would.
I do believe this. I do believe that leaders are made, not born. Leadership is a skill like many other skills. And if somebody seems to have natural capacity, it might have just been because they learned it when they were younger. They might have learned it from teachers, or maybe had a great boss, and they simply learned those skills. But no one is born a natural leader. It doesn't exist. It's like no one's born self-confident. It's just, you know, we learn self-confidence from our parents and our teachers, and it requires constant nursing and attention, just like leadership. It's a practice, a learnable, practicable skill. And the people who become great leaders are students of leadership. You don't just get promoted and suddenly you're a great leader. I mean, if you want to be a good accountant, you have to study. If you want to be a good designer, you have to study. You have to practice. Well, if you want to be a good leader, you have to study and practice. It's not some natural gift. And even if there's natural capacity, like talent, you still have to hone that talent and work very hard. You know, even professional athletes who have talent, or musicians, they all practice and rehearse a great deal to hone their craft. Leadership is exactly the same.
And you talk about the need for great leaders to have a combination of empathy and perspective. Can you talk a bit about that combination with some examples associated with each?
That's one of the essential skills of leadership, which is to have empathy. Listening skills, the ability to give and receive feedback, patience. Example of empathy in work is a fairly common scenario is walking into someone's office and saying, you've missed your numbers for the third quarter in a row. We've had this conversation before. If you don't fix your numbers in the fourth quarter, I don't know what's going to happen. That's fairly normal. Empathy, you walk into their office and say, you've missed your numbers for the third quarter in a row. We've had this conversation before. Are you okay? I'm worried about you. Is everything okay? What's going on? That's empathy. It's having concern for the person rather than just thinking that they're a problem.
You also highlight the need for perspective as an additional characteristic. Can you take a moment to talk a bit about that as well?
Yeah, I would think it's a different perspective, which is when we're junior, we are responsible for getting the work done, and we are responsible for the results of our work. When you're senior, we are no longer responsible for getting the job done because we don't do the job. There's not a CEO on the planet responsible for the results. A CEO is responsible for the people who are responsible for the people who are responsible for the people who are responsible for the results. And it's the effective hierarchy of good leadership that produces great work. A senior executive isn't responsible for customer service because they don't talk to the customer. An executive is responsible for the people who are responsible for the people who are responsible for the people who talk to the customer. The former CEO of the Ritz-Carlton said it best. He says, my lowest paid employees have all the contact with my customer. So how do you ensure a luxury, high quality, high customer service brand if it's not for good leadership? Because we can't scream and yell at people to take care of the customer. That's not going to work. Those people have to feel like that their bosses care about them as human beings. And that's why they direct their energy into taking care of the customer. It's a very human experience, leadership. And I think very often we forget that.
That's a great point. I also found it really particularly interesting that you highlight some examples of organizations that have gone from great success to a downward trajectory, only to have, with better leadership, pull themselves back into a better performance. You mentioned the contrast of Mike Duke and Steve Ballmer at Walmart and Microsoft, respectively, compared to Doug McMillon and Satya Nadella. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that, because there's a hopeful message there that even organizations that are on the wrong footing, and even organizations at great scale, obviously the larger the scale in many ways, the more difficult it is to change the culture that's necessary in order to regain a leadership position. And yet these two of the largest of all companies were able to do so. Can you highlight a couple of the lessons from that?
Well, I think very often, you have these new executives that come in to quote unquote perform a turnaround, And the question is, are they doing it with an infinite mindset or a finite mindset? And an executive comes in who does a turnaround with a finite mindset. It's all about cost cutting, right? And they may get the numbers back on track, but it doesn't last. And as soon as that leader leaves, the company is back in trouble again. I think a more effective turnaround is stabilizing the foundation. It's strengthening the culture. It's restoring trust. It's not just this exercise in cost cutting, and we've seen it happen. We saw Steve Ballmer take over Microsoft and bring a finite mindset. The company became much more short term focused. Became much more numbers focused. Much more Wall Street focused. To the detriment of the organization, to the detriment of the culture. They could no longer attract top talent. And Satya Nadella has come in with a sense of vision and cause. He's restored trust. He's restored the culture. He's brought back some grandiosity and vision to the organization. And now Microsoft has become a great place to work again that people want to go work for and much more innovative. And Doug McMillon is doing the same thing at Walmart. Mike Duke brought a really awful sense of short-termism to Walmart. And it did great damage to the brand, and it was scandal ridden about how they treated their employees and how they treated their customers. And once again, Doug McMillon is going back to the very roots of the organization, to what Sam Walton himself stood for, which is taking care of the average working American. And he's restored that sense of cause. And once again, Walmart is moving back in the right direction. Now, these are large organizations. These changes don't happen overnight. But I think what both those CEOs are doing is bringing an infinite mindset to their organization and really having a very, very positive impact.
Simon, I'd love to talk a little bit more about how you got involved in leadership and in writing and developing your own firm, Cynic Partners, after a career spent, at least in your early career, in advertising. What inspired you to go down the path that you have?
My career has been largely an accident, to be honest. I had a small marketing firm called Cynic Partners many years ago, and everything superficially seemed to be good, except I didn't want to go to work anymore. We had good clients, we did good work, but I was uninspired and I'd lost my passion. And people gave me sort of stupid advice, you know, follow your bliss, find your passion. Like, thanks, what am I supposed to do with that? You know, I was doing the same thing and I didn't love it anymore. I used to love it. So that wasn't helpful. And it was a dark period, so I was embarrassed the fact that I didn't want to go to work because superficially I was living the American dream. You know, I own my own business. I was my own boss. So I kept that. I kept that to myself, and all of my energy went into pretending that I was happier, more successful, and more in control than I actually felt. And it wasn't until a dear friend came to me that I'm worried about you. Something's wrong. Something's different. Did I come clean? Told her how I really felt, and it released lifted a huge weight off my shoulders, and I could take all that energy that I went to lying, hiding, and faking every day and could redirect it into finding a solution. And that solution that I found was the thing called the why, I knew what I did and I knew how I did it, but I didn't know why. And I became obsessed with the why, and it restored my passion to extraordinary level. I did what anybody else would do when you discover something beautiful. I shared it with my friends. They started making crazy life changes. And people just kept inviting me to come talk to them about it and share it. And I just kept saying yes. And before I knew it, I was being invited to speak and I was offered a book deal and, as things went. So it was really quite an accident. I was just so inspired by this idea of why and open to talking about it and love talking about it that opportunities arose. And I was just open to following a new and uncertain path.
And I'd love to understand a little bit more about your methods. You've obviously just released a book, your fifth. And now you're no doubt supporting that book, doing interviews like this one, for example. But, as you now turn to your next topic, what's that process look like? Do you have several ideas that are kind of in the hopper and evaluate them and reevaluate them to determine whether or not they're worth your time for a deeper investigation? Are you sort of wandering the world and search for that inspiration? How does the process work?
My work is semi-autobiographical. It's my own journey. And my journey, it turns out, is pretty similar to a lot of people's journeys. You know, it's just the journey of life. It's the human journey. And my first book was about the loss of my own passion. And a lot of us feel that way, that we're not passionate about our work and we want to be. And my second book was about trust. You know, I was struggling to trust people and at work, I didn't feel like I trusted people. And so that caused me concern. And I went to try and find out how to learn to trust. And it wasn't supposed to be a book. It was just supposed to help me solve a problem. And it ended up becoming Leaders Eat Last. And this new book is, I'm an idealist. I talk about a world in which the vast majority of us wake up every single morning inspired, feel safe at work, and return home fulfilled at the end of the day. And, I'm constantly accused of being a crazy idealist, or people are saying to me that your ideas won't work in the real world, or you don't understand business. And when I discovered James Carse's work, when I discovered this articulation of finite and infinite games, it made me realize, oh my goodness, all these people that keep telling us that we don't understand business, turns out they don't understand business. They don't actually know the game that they're in. So it helped. It made me realize that this discomfort that so many of us feel at work, that this can't be the right way to run a business, we're actually right in there. And the people who keep telling us that we're the clueless ones, they're actually wrong. And so this is just my own journey. Every book I've written, I think, is the last book I'll ever write. So I think this one might be the last one too. And my journey continues. And assuming that I have more struggles and I'm able to find solutions for those struggles, there may or may not be another book in the works, but I have no clue. I never had ambitions to be an author. And it's sort of amazing to me that I am one. But I'm not in search of another book. No, I'm just on my journey. And like I said, it's the same journey as all of us. And so for me, my books and my talks, they're just a way of, I think, inviting people to all go on the journey together.
Very interesting. And does that mean that you don't have a team around you? Obviously you've got publishers and so on, but do you work alone? Do your research alone? Do you involve others? How do you involve others in your projects once that you're inspired?
Yeah, we have a team because we have a company, but I write my own books. I do invite somebody to help me do research, of course. And I have an editor to help me, of course. And I have a dear friend who, when I have an idea set, I have somebody to bounce it off. But I formed the idea set long before all of that comes to bear. I'm not really doing research looking for an idea. I'm constantly taking in the world. I'm an anthropologist at heart, and I'm constantly taking in the world and looking for patterns again to solve real problems. They're not academic in nature. So, of course, none of us can do things completely alone. I mean, of course we need help, and I definitely need help. But in terms of writing books, once I decide to write a book, then I pick up the phone and start calling everybody and saying, okay, here we go again.
Get the team back together. I saw a really fascinating lecture that you gave, where you describe millennials, a generation that is often dismissed by those older than them and those employing them. And you talk about some of the real struggles that they face due to factors like, the way in which they are parented perhaps differently than the past generations, the impact that technology has on them as well. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because you, at least in the lecture that I saw, began with that sort of common thesis that they are, you were sort of tongue in cheek, but talking about how they are broken, they're difficult to lead and so on. But then you peel back the onion as to the rationale behind that, and then ultimately conclude that it's the rest of us that need to find ways to change in order to lead them in a better way. Could you share some of those perspectives, please?
So I think millennials are accused of things, they're accused of being hard to lead and entitled and all these things. And what I attempt to do in that interview is be a little more empathetic, to shed a little light on why we may perceive them that way. And though they're, you have to remember, every generation forms a worldview based on the experiences they have when they come of age. Our grandparents may have been miserly and frugal because they grew up during the Great Depression and the Second World War. Well, there's nothing wrong with them. It's just that their worldview was formed based on the world events as they came of age. And baby boomers came of age during Richard Nixon and the Vietnam War. So it's not a surprise that they tend to be cynical of authority figures. And so the millennials are the first generation who came of age at the millennium, the first generation to come of age where cell phones and social media were ubiquitous, post September 11th world, or that around that time. And so it forms their worldview. They also grew up in a world where the business practices of the 80s, 90s had fully taken hold, where things like shareholder supremacy and mass layoffs were now normal. These were theories proposed in the late 1970s that were normalized in the 80s and 90s. So this population, this generation, came of age watching their parents work really, really hard and then lose their jobs through no fault of their own. It's just because the company missed its arbitrary projections at the end of the year, and their parents were asked to pay a steeper price because they were part of a cost-cutting effort, a means of balancing the books. And so they're right to be cynical about business today, and they're right to mistrust leaders in companies today, because that's what they saw growing up. And what's more, unfortunately, because cell phones and social media were ubiquitous when they came of age, and we didn't realize back then the deleterious effects and the addictive quality of these things, much like the early days of cigarettes. We just didn't know they were addictive in the early days. We didn't know they were bad for us in the early days. That this addictive qualities of these things have hurt many millennials' ability to form deep, meaningful relationships, or learn to cope with stress, ask for help, things like that. And so it's less of a criticism and more of an empathetic view that though they bring many advantages as a generation, they're very open-minded and inclusive generation. Like every generation, there's pluses and minuses. And I think it was just more about learning to understand a different generation rather than default to criticizing them.
Simon Sinek, thanks so much for joining me on Technovation today, talking a bit about the lessons from your most recent book, The Infinite Game, talking a bit further about your methods as well. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for your help.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Gene Kim, author of The Unicorn Project, an award-winning CTO, and a founder of IT Revolution.